One, two, three. What a year it's been, Sean. What a year it's been already.
Already? It's only been 7 days.
Yeah, seven days and we have two major processor vulnerabilities that affect basically every computer ever made.
Yeah.
It's still in service.
Yeah, and then I'll have to link to it in the show notes, but I saw another Medium article that was circulating. I think the title was How I Steal Your Credit Card Numbers and Passwords.
Yes, I read that. Yeah. Super good.
Yeah, it was super interesting. Some things that I'd never, I mean, you always think about package managers and security, right? You think like, oh, someone else is worrying about this, but you don't actually know that someone else is worrying about it. And I don't want to throw stones specifically at JavaScript or the JavaScript ecosystem, but there's so many packages. Dependencies have dependencies have dependencies have dependencies all the way down. There's so many of them, you know? It's just, I feel like it's encouraged just to have things be so modular and so small, like Leftpad being, you know, one of the most famous examples, right? Just such a small thing that just pads a string. But yeah, I had never really thought about it like that, like saying, oh, this could actually be a thing that someone does relatively easily.
Right. I set up a new JavaScript project the other day and I sent you a screenshot of this. I installed Nuxt and
And
the NPM feedback was like 1,100 something packages installed.
Yeah, it's insane.
It's like I certainly haven't gone through and read the source and vetted everything for every single one of those, and certainly not the minified source that is actually being, like, whatever my application is actually running. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, yeah. I think a really good point was that you can ship two different versions, so you can ship one version to GitHub and ship another version to NPM entirely. So it's funny because if I remember the article correctly, it was like, but what about this? And then the person's like, well, not so fast. We can just get around it by doing this. So they're just like shooting holes in all like the quick answers that people might have to say like, oh, this isn't actually a problem or it wouldn't be a problem.
Yeah. It goes into detail of like how the attack would actually work, and it shows code examples and how you can hide these things and even get around things like content security policies. It's actually pretty in depth, a really, really good read. We'll definitely need to have a link to that in show notes. It's superb.
Well, I guess to explain how they were doing it, they came up with a package that they thought people might like or people might use as a dependency. And I think this case was colorizing the web console output or the web inspector output. And so what they did was they went around and submitted PRs for easy fixes to some popular repositories. And they didn't actually do this. It was just a scenario. But the article outlines going around submitting PRs and then just kind of like adding that as a dependency as a part of the submission. And of course, a lot of maintainers would be like, oh, why did you add this dependency? But some might not. Some might be in a hurry or, you know, some might just be like, that's fine and just accept it. And so that would be, for them, that's like the easy way to get their payload out to users, because that would be much easier than just saying, hey, everyone use this new thing. You know, there's much less scrutiny then because it's just a dependency that's in the node modules folder. You know, it's just part of the massive blob that gets pulled in. So they get the payload in that way. And then basically they just set up some event listeners to look for any forms and any input types that are password, or I can't remember if it's email or number or whatever, but anyhow, yeah, it just, as soon as there's some type of event happens, it just sends that off to a separate server. And so that way that the user could then inspect the data coming through and see, you know, do I want to keep it? Does this have information I can use to steal identity or whatever? It's pretty interesting.
Yeah. And it's really important to note that this all is a hypothetical situation. There hasn't been a known example of this actually happening in the world, even though the article presents it as though it has happened. I thought the coolest part to me is just that, it's something that people do want. People do use libraries that color console output. That is a thing, a legitimate thing. Mm-hmm. Yep. And even if you get a PR from somebody and they're like, hey, I fixed this bug and added some console log coloring, you're probably, in most cases, you're probably not actually going to think twice about that. You're going to click through the library, maybe look at the code, be like, oh yeah, this looks like it does what it does. And even though you've done that, you still aren't necessarily safe. And so his recommendation at the end of the article is that for anything where you're accepting like credit card input or really sensitive things like that, login pages, sign up pages, it might be a good idea to have like a separate build for those individual pages that doesn't use any external code whatsoever, or at least to the extent possible. That means no analytics libraries or NPM packages or anything. Only yeah. stuff that you've written and that you can guarantee is clean code.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea, and it wouldn't be that difficult to do with something like Webpack. Just have it roll out a new module or a new bundle for those specific pages, you know? That is a good idea.
Yeah, it's definitely something I'm going to consider at least when I'm building new systems out, because that's a pretty scary attack, and it would actually be very easy for somebody to pull off.
Yeah,
there's no reason it couldn't happen.
There was, I think there was a similar, not exactly as nefarious, but if I remember correctly, there was a package for Sublime Text called Enhanced Sidebar or Sidebar Enhancements that was doing something like that. Obviously, it wasn't stealing like emails and passwords, but it was like logging. It was logging probably way more information than it should. And I remember, I might have to see if I can dig this up, but I remember there was kind of a thing that happened in GitHub or around the community. They're like, this is not okay. Why are you doing this? And I don't even know how many hundreds of thousands of people have had installed that and just, you know, just went about their way before someone noticed that something was going on.
Yeah, it's really, really scary. Running anybody else's code is something I think that we should all probably consider a lot more before just doing it blindly.
Yeah.
That even kind of lines up with the Spectre and Meltdown. These two big security processor architecture issues that have been discovered in the last, or at least made public in the last week. Where now I'm even rethinking the whole idea of using cloud services, because these kind of vulnerabilities can pop up at any time. And if I'm running on a box that is potentially sharing code with other tenants, then now it's just like, now that there's this huge thing out there and there's going to be new variations on Spectre, certainly for quite some time, because it's a really low level, really deep rooted architectural issue. Man, that makes me really wary of running stuff on cloud services right now.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, and it sucks because it's so convenient. You know, I think obviously like cloud adoption is huge. Everything's in the cloud. I remember seeing tweets about when Amazon would go down or AWS would go down, people would be like, oh, I can't even change the sensitivity of my mouse because AWS is down. And they're talking about the Razer Synapse app. So you have certain Razer mouses. Wow, I'm having trouble. On certain Razer mice, you can change the sensitivity by clicking a couple of buttons, and that would work because obviously they couldn't communicate with the server. That was all of their devices capture usage statistics, and you can turn that off. But if you don't, then it's kind of funny that it seems like they didn't account for that case where like the person wasn't using or wasn't connected to the internet, or if like the server just was down for some reason. But yeah, cloud stuff is so convenient, you know. You log on to Heroku or DigitalOcean or AWS or whatever and spin up a new server. You know, it's a virtual server, obviously. So you're on a shared host. I don't even know how to start to decouple myself from that.
Yeah, it's really going to force a lot of people and a lot of companies to rethink their deployment strategies in general, just the whole thing, bottom up.
yeah.
I mean, I guess I'm probably going to be starting to look back into co-location more, at least for anything critical. And then just having, you know, living in a data center with other users, because I'm not going to buy a whole rack or whatever. I'm one person. But for my personal stuff, I might want to have an actual computer sitting somewhere that I am the only tenant of.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I remember, I think when I first met you, you were using like Mac Mini Colo, I think it was, for some stuff.
Yeah, I used Mac Mini Colo very happily for like 6 years. Great service. I'm not currently, just because I was like, well, I love using these cloud providers. I'm not gonna say any names of cloud providers right now. But I love using these cloud providers, and it's so easy and convenient. Let me just do that for a while. And so that's what I've been doing. And now it's like, gee, maybe that co-location thing was pretty smart from the get-go.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's just such a big thing to even think about and entertain. I was going to say, I actually read some tweets, and my favorite were by a guy named Rene Ritchie. And I'll link to his stuff in the show notes, but he also has a podcast called Vector, and he has a few, I think three episodes now, where he breaks down Meltdown and Spectre in depth, and just kind of explains from a technical aspect what's happening and what the fixes would look like and what the effects from the fixes would be. So that's a really good resource to check it out. I didn't even know that spectral analysis was a thing. That was so fascinating to me when I learned about that the CPUs did that. It makes sense. You know, it makes sense as to why that would be a performance thing, but it just never dawned on me that the CPUs would be doing that.
Yeah, CPUs are wildly complex, and like most people don't have any real understanding of what they're doing under the hood.
Yeah. So, I mean, to like put it in, like to break it down a little bit, spectral analysis would be when the CPU gets to a conditional, like if else, it'll actually execute both sides, and then it'll figure out, did I do the right one? And if I did, then continue. And if I didn't, it'll roll back and go to the other branch, but it had already been executed. So essentially it would have saved time there. And that's where the security problem was that, so basically there weren't proper boundaries put around some of the memory. And so if you did that, you could force it to, you basically could force it to read things back to you. And that's how people were accessing things that were stored in memory, like passwords and such. Obviously that's a very, very shallow explanation of it, but just the idea that the CPU is like, yeah, I'll just execute both. And then if we guessed wrong by automatically going left, then we'll just go right. And we've already executed. We already have the result of that expression. So, you know, we'll just continue on.
Man, it's all way above my head. As somebody yeah. who's been doing this for quite some time. I guess the outstanding thing to me about this whole thing is that 20 years, we're talking about 20 years of these things existing. And just nobody knew
mm-hmm.
these yeah. issues, and that is really scary, because that's one of those things, like it's like when you have issues with OpenSSL
right,
a couple
yeah,
years
yeah.
ago,
yeah,
the Heartbleed stuff and all that. When these issues have been dormant for so long, these issues that affect basically everything on the internet, and then they just suddenly are out there in the wild. Jeez, man, crazy year.
I was also thinking about it from this angle too. Like, if I weren't on a cloud provider, I would be responsible. I would basically have to set aside time to be reading and scanning for disclosures like this and patch them myself. Whereas all the major cloud providers are like, all right, we patched it. You know, they kind of did it forever. It sucks, because obviously everyone in that platform was susceptible to the problem.
Well, They patched it. Like, most of the cloud providers have done patches, but
yeah.
I'm not concerned so much about the immediate issues. I'm concerned about a new exploit based on Spectre stuff
in
3 months or 6 months or whatever. That's my real concern with cloud hosting going forward. They obviously are going to respond faster than I can, but if there is a hole, then you're vulnerable the entire time. Whereas if you're the only tenant on the machine,
I see.
There's just a lot less risk there. At least that's what it's seeming like at the moment.
It's almost closer to the side of like security by obscurity, right? Since you're the only one, you're hanging out by yourself, and you're not on like a super populated planet, there's obviously less chance that someone's going to try and take advantage of that.
Well, it's almost like the only security is physical security. Like if somebody has physical access to your machine, they can always own that machine. Like that's just kind of the thing. And by using cloud services, we've just kind of accepted for a really long time as an industry, I guess, that, oh, well, anybody that I happen to be sharing this box with can just own me if these exploits come around. Right. But I believe strongly enough that that's not going to happen, that I'm okay with accepting that security risk for the ease of use. And now I'm at least personally rethinking that whole thing, because it's like, is the ease of use actually worth this? And this is something I'm going to have to keep thinking about and keep asking over the next months and years at this point. This is a big deal.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It really is. I was thinking about it from another angle too, like thinking about what parts of my app are mission critical and what parts of my app actually hold the sensitive data. And is there a way for me to extract that sensitive data to a separate location that's more secure than say data that would be more publicly accessible? To me, that might feel like a better, more accessible trade-off, I guess, but still you're having to make significant changes and everything. I don't know. Obviously don't have any answers, but it is pretty wild.
Yeah. I'm not going to claim to know any of the answers either. It's just, this is something that the whole industry is going to be thinking about for such a long time and really reevaluating, I think, a lot of assumptions that have been made over the last decade or so.
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure. It was surreal, reading Twitter. It was almost like a splash of cold water, because I hadn't worked in like 2 weeks. I forced myself to not work at all for 2 weeks, over my break, which is the first time I've had that much time off in a while without actually doing anything. And so I was in Iceland and I was sitting in the car, and we were driving, and then I happened to check Twitter and I was like, what the crap? I think I saw a hashtag for Spectre, and I was like, that looks interesting. And then I clicked on it and I was like, oh no.
Yeah, that was, I was on vacation when Heartbleed dropped.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, that's a hell of a thing to come back to.
Yeah. Yeah. So I looked it up, obviously read about it. I told my coworkers about it, and I was like, oh, by the way, you should know about this. And so I linked them to a couple of good articles and an explainer. And then obviously by then, AWS and Amazon had already patched things. What was interesting, and I'll have to find sources for this too, but what was interesting is what I heard on one of the, what was that called? One of the Vector podcasts, they're saying that the disclosure actually happened a week early because of some people that were working in open source on the Linux kernel had noticed something. And so people started snooping around, and that's how this was actually disclosed. It came out a week before it was scheduled to be disclosed to the public.
Oh, geez. I actually hadn't heard that. That's
yeah. So that's why it was such a weird, because like normally people are right on top of it, right? Like, so there's a disclosure and everyone's like, boom, we're on it. It's done. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's why this time it was like, oh, here's a thing. And then everyone's like, where's Amazon on this? Where's Apple on this? Like, why aren't people weighing in on it? And that's why, because it was actually disclosed a week early.
Jeez. Man.
Yeah, I think people just saw some patches coming through and they're like, do you know about this? You know, and just kind of spread from there. But yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting when I heard about it. But yeah, I guess when you think about all that stuff, it has been quite a couple of weeks. Yep.
Hell of a year. Oh man.
Yeah.
So, well, during the last couple of weeks of 2017, I finally did it. I finally started reading through all of the Elixir docs and going through all the tutorials and going through all Phoenix docs and all the Ecto docs and just really absorbing all of this ecosystem. It's been a lot of reading. It's been so much reading. But man, early impressions are real, real solid, I gotta say.
I was getting frustrated with you because you're like, oh, I'm just reading the docs. And I was like, have you written it yet? And you're just like, I'm just reading the docs. I was like, will you write something? Like, I'm just going to finish reading. I mean, that's smart. You know, you just get like a really good blanket overview. And we've talked about this in episodes, read everything first. But I was like, I just want you to write something and make something. And then I want to hear.
Oh, believe me. I did too. But I figured especially for Elixir, since it is kind of a new paradigm for me, I've never done a pure functional language like this, it's new territory, and it really is a different way of thinking about a lot of problems and how you want to solve them, how you want to approach them. So I thought I got to go through, I got to read a lot of examples, I got to read a lot of code, so I start to get these idioms into place and start to understand how, just how to write in this language idiomatically and well. And I think that's paid off so far. I still honestly get pretty confused with some syntax things and just some quirks of the language. But man, I can already feel it reshaping how I think about problems.
Isn't it interesting?
Yeah. It completely, my brain just works in a slightly different way when thinking about things in Elixir, and it's a way that I like.
Yeah.
I feel as I'm able to break a problem down into its individual components. And when I say individual components, I mean like the actual individual functions are more concise and just tighter and shorter.
It's
awesome.
Do you think that's because you're probably not thinking about how to manage, like how does the state look? How does this thing hold state? And you're just thinking more about like, how does it work functionally?
Yes, I think that's part of it. And I think another one of the things that's been really helpful to me so far, when it finally clicked for me, is Phoenix contexts.
Mm-hmm.
I love the idea of having your app code and then having your web code separated. That as a concept is so simple, really, but it's actually been really powerful and freeing for me, because now it's like, I look at this, I'm attempting something really overly ambitious for a first project. It's like a real-time multiplayer game designed with lag compensation and client movement prediction and all that kind of stuff that you would see in like a Valve kind of game, where they have like really good netcode. I'm trying to actually go through and write this all out from scratch.
Good grief.
Because I've got this awesome system that enables me to do all this stuff, and I don't know. I feel like I should at least try to take advantage of it with my first project for a little bit of fun.
Yeah. So you're already messing with gen servers and stuff now. Because I think
that's the main bit of what I've been doing. Like I've written very little actual web code so far. It's been almost all just stuff inside a gen server and writing out game logic and loops and all that.
See, I wish I would have had, I wish I could approach it from that angle. I think for me, it was a little bit weird learning Elixir because I had to just make it work. And I was porting over things that were written differently, very differently than I think, but also, you know, obviously for more of an object oriented style. So it was an interesting thing for me where I was learning Elixir to write the web layer basically. And so it hasn't been until recently that I actually started playing around gen servers, which I think are super cool. And I'm now realizing that I can rewrite a number of things for Design Collective just to use gen servers that would simplify things. But yeah, I think the whole OTP layer with like gen server and agent are really, really cool and super powerful.
Well, and stuff like ETS, which is actually a pure Erlang library, not an Elixir thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of like Redis, but it's just built in. It's just there and it is really fast and can communicate between nodes on the same network without any additional work, basically. It's free. Right.
Yeah, it's free.
And
yeah.
That enables a class of features in applications and in web applications in particular that have been historically pretty difficult to deal with, or just added a lot of moving parts to your system.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I'm all about it. This has been great so far.
Yeah, I think
I get the buzz.
Because you see, like, I'm sure looking on the outside in, you hear all this buzz, like people are like, oh, this is so great, and OTP this, OTP that, but until you actually kind of look behind the curtain and be like, what is this OTP stuff that they keep talking about? And then you realize like how much work it actually does for you if you need that sort of feature, you know, if you need to be able to link nodes together and have them communicate and share state and all that stuff. Having that just happen for you is pretty wild. And the cool thing is that originally, you know, obviously Erlang was written for telecoms and phone switches, and it still runs, from what I understand, it still runs a pretty large portion of Europe's phone switching system. It turns out that that's a pretty similar problem space to the web. and how the web communication works between nodes and users and sending payloads back and forth. So it's pretty awesome that we can basically rely on what, like, the 2 decades of work and problem solving that was done there in terms of like queues and messaging systems and linking nodes together like that, and we can just use it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really incredible how much you get for free with the ecosystem. And these tools all mesh together so well, because if I have like a single page app with state backed by Vuex, I can implement real-time updates, like edits to a product you're viewing or whatever, just popping in on the screen. I could, with Phoenix and Vuex combined, you can have a WebSocket version of that up in like 20 lines of code total, 30 lines of code for a simple example.
Right. Yeah.
But
yeah.
Like that's combined client and server. It's ridiculous how concise you can be with these pretty common things that you would want to do in an advanced web app.
Yeah. I just feel like there's been so much thought put into everything. Like everything. I haven't like run into a number of sharp edges. I mean, like I haven't done a whole lot with channels. I've done some with channels and WebSockets, but it's just put together really well.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the same impression I've gotten, not just from Elixir, Phoenix, and Ecto, like the big guns, but every little open source library I've looked at so far, every bit of code, the documentation is all fantastic. Everything just seems really well thought through. Every aspect of it.
Yeah, I love my documentation is one of my favorite things. How it works into it, like it's just part of the language, which is it's one of my favorite things. The fact that the module docs and you know the doc blocks, it's I don't know, it just makes it so nice. And then pair that with you know, obviously whatever editor you're using, but for me VS Code, I'm hovering over function names and I'm getting the documentation that I wrote for myself. So a lot of times in the Elixir source, for example, I was just reading through some more list functions, and the list functions have examples. So it'll say like, this is what this function does, this is what it returns. Oh, and here are 2 examples of it actually being used and what the return values are. So I can just hover over that and then I see actual examples. And so for DK, I try to comment every public function. I certainly haven't, but I try to. And so as I'm using the code base and I'm looking around, I'm constantly being reminded of this is what this function does, and here's an example of it being used. And also here's an example of the function erroring as well, like what would be returned in an error state. And to me, that's been one of the most useful things. And it's cool that it's pretty much, it might as well be just part of writing an Elixir app is writing out that documentation.
Sure. Yeah. That's actually been one of the things that I've struggled with a little bit, is the syntax of the types and stuff, as they call them.
Yeah.
They're not types like you would think of them in OOP, but what is this function going to, this function definition going to expect?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Some of the documentation syntax has just been a little bit strange for me, but the overall idea of it is, yeah, it's just fantastic. I love seeing those little pop-ups in VS Code, which I have switched to. Yeah.
Uh-oh.
I switched it. I figured if I'm going to jump into this new ecosystem, I might as well also switch my text editor. It's time.
I feel like I need like 10 Merlin bells right now.
Yeah.
Just like clanging or a couple gongs. Maybe that would produce the same amount of noise.
It's been fine. I don't hate it. I'm slowly getting all my little idiosyncrasies work into the keyboard shortcuts and all that. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just expected with a text editor change though.
Yeah. I feel the same way. Occasionally I go back and use Sublime, and Sublime feels nice to use. It's so fast and so smooth feeling. It's weird to describe a text editor feel, but it feels nice, you know. And VS Code doesn't quite feel as nice, but man, it has a lot of bells and whistles.
Yeah, it really does. It really does. And especially for something like Elixir, where you have a bit more, the language gives you a bit more than JavaScript traditionally has.
So I know that you liked using CoffeeScript. I mean, obviously, this isn't the main reason you used it, but obviously, it's nice to get compiler warnings and compiler errors and things like that. I find it really nice to, as I'm writing my server over my server side code, to actually get compile warnings and errors and stuff like that. I that's one feature. It's not even really a feature of Elixir. It's just one thing that I love about using it, is that it's compiled.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I love compiling things, man. It's awesome. It's awesome because you do, again, you get so much for free. There's so many things. There's a whole class of errors that just aren't possible anymore in production, which is just a really nice kind of stress reliever for me.
Yeah. Well, even down to like the messaging you get around performance stuff or warnings, like, oh, this is pulled in but not actually used, or you use this,
right,
you created this alias and never used it, or this variable is never used. And that kind of stuff is, that goes a long way, you know, over the course of a year, 2 years, 3 years of maintaining a code base.
So much less junk will accumulate. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's a big deal. It really is.
And then I think I mentioned to you earlier, Credo and Dogma, which are two, of the big linters for Elixir. Mm-hmm. I've used Credo a little bit. I want to use it a lot more, but I think that you'll find once you run those, you'll get a whole nother depth of knowledge and information from the linter. So not only does it give you like errors and warnings, but also it says like, oh, this is a performance problem. And it almost seems like intelligent to me in the messaging that it gets, like, this is a security issue, this is a performance problem, et cetera, et cetera. It's almost like having a person check your code for you, which is very helpful for me, you know, because I'm certainly not an expert and I kind of had to just make things work, you know? So I feel like I'm playing catch up as at the same time as I'm building. So having tools that are that in depth and that kind of have that polish to them, I don't know. It's just, I'm feeling, I just grow to rely on that more and more. And so it's nice that Elixir just has that.
Yeah, it is. So one more thing on Elixir, and then I actually got to go write some more Elixir because I'm loving it.
Get the bug.
For me, a big barrier when I'm going to look at a new language is always just like, how do I version manage this? Because that's historically just been kind of a pain and something that I don't want to have to think about after the initial setup. Mm-hmm. And I asked around a little bit and I got a couple of responses, but I ended up going with curl, KERL, and Kix. So curl actually manages your Erlang installations, and then Kix manages your Elixir versions. Mm-hmm. Both super great tools, and they were really just pretty much set up and then install and forget until I need to upgrade a version or whatever, and then it's one command. So I would really recommend anybody who's looking to get up and running with this stuff, with Elixir and this whole ecosystem, check those two tools out, because they made it a lot easier for me to get in without having to, it just made it easier to get up and running with the language on my machine.
Oh yeah. I used Kix for a little bit too. I don't know why. I don't remember why I'm not using it now. I really don't, but I've used Kix and it worked really well. If I were going to say one last thing, before you go back and start writing some more Elixir, is, with 1.6, there's a mixed format task coming out, which will automatically format your code a la Prettier or ESLint fix. And if you don't want to, I think Elixir 1.6 is in release candidate phase. If you don't want to install a release candidate, there's a site called elixirformatter.com. I think it's just smash the one word like that, no hyphen or space, like obviously no space, but basically it's like you can just copy and paste your Elixir code into it and it'll format it for you, and then you can paste it back into your editor. So I've been using that a ton. If you're not sure what the idiomatic way or like the Elixir way of formatting a data structure or formatting case or width or whatever, I just toss it in there and then paste it back into my code.
That's cool. I like that that's going to be a native language feature.
Oh, it's going to be awesome. And I bet there's already one for VS Code that'll just... that'll fix it on save or
do it on save. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So now my JavaScript is being prettified on save and my Elixir is getting prettified on save. 2018.
Hell of a year.
The future. Yeah. All right. Well, I will let you go. Get back to building things.